all, this is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, the life and times of Hillary Clinton, her domestic life, and stance on women. Why? Because virtually the entire mainstream media, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, the Boston Herald, most of the networks, have not challenged Hillary Clinton's background in the White House, because it was known at the time that she was not just the passive wife of an acting president, she was an active wife who shared in many of the decisions that would end up manifesting in our lifetimes. So she holds some moral responsibility for those choices, because it would be reversed today. Her husband would not be passive. He would also be there to consult, give advice and input. So you're really looking at bringing into the most powerful office in the United States and the world a person whose background has not been critically analyzed. We intend to share some critical analysis today. My guest is Roger Stone. He is a respected political consultant. He is also GOP campaign strategist and author. He's worked intimately as a senior staffer on 8 national election campaigns, including with Nixon, Reagan, and George Bush Sr. In the past, he's been regarded as the Republicans' primary hitman. He was the keeper of Nixon's flame during Nixon's post-presidential years, serving as Nixon's man in Washington. He has worked on many election campaigns and was instrumental in the bringing down of Eliot Spitzer's governorship. Roger has since left the GOP and aligned with the Libertarian Party. He writes articles for the Huffington Post, the Daily Caller. His site is stonezone.com. And he's been profiled in numerous television programs. He also has written on the JFK assassination implicating President Lyndon Johnson, and his most recent book is The Clinton's War on Women, which thoroughly presents the evidence behind why Clinton should be behind bars, not as a public servant. Nice to have you with us today, Roger.
Gary, I'm delighted to be here.
Roger, I would like this interview to focus primarily on Hillary because, depending upon the news source, she is the front runner in the Democratic race, or at least running neck and neck with Bernie Sanders. And, of course, she was mainstream media. It's all on her side, except for Fox. And we know that media bias towards large corporations and Wall Streets. So why she would be the front runner, given the Clintons' background and decades of corruption, is an enigma. But be that as it may, her popularity still rides on myths and a legendary mystique that the Clintons still managed to hold onto as registered Democrats and corporate Democrats believe in them completely. So I'd like you to primarily focus on deconstructing this mystique with facts, no innuendo, no hearsay, primary source material that is qualified, so we can understand who she is on these issues. That said, right now Hillary's strongest base for the presidency is women. She has been praised by feminists of all stripes and working women as a heroine to gender equality and social services for working women and single moms. So I'd like to deconstruct this myth for us. Perhaps you saw a short analysis published on the site Zero Hedge this week that showed when Hillary headed the State Department, she was paying women on the staff 72 cents to the dollar that male staff members made. So as far as equal pay goes, Hillary's track record seems to indicate the contrary. What are some of the other indications and issues on record that women should pay closer attention to about Hillary as the heroine of women's rights? The forum is yours.
Well, first of all, it's impossible to analyze the record of Hillary Clinton without looking at her relationship with her husband, because, as you indicated earlier, she was a veritable co-president during her husband's White House years. She vetted the cabinet. She chose specific cabinet members, such as Janet Reno, such as Donna Shalala. She concocted the administration's health care plan, which, as you know, was rejected by the Congress. She filed the Travelgate office when she wanted to insert her cronies. She charged those running the office with illegality and impropriety. They were all cleared. And it became clear that she just wanted to shift that business to an Arkansas-based travel agency run by her associates. She's a full partner in this relationship, and I think the most troubling thing about this is that her husband is a Bill Cosby-style sexual predator. I'm not talking about consensual sex, girlfriends, mistresses, one-night stands. If I were to write that book, it would be an encyclopedia. I'm focused on something much, much darker, which is Bill's serial rape or sexual assault of various women. And then, just as importantly, perhaps now more importantly, Hillary's role as the desk officer, the point person, in terms of intimidating these women to keep them silent. During the both the Paula Jones matter, in which the Clintons ultimately had to pay, well, in Bill's case, had to pay Paula Jones $850,000, because after 2 years of denying that he'd ever met her or knew what she was talking about, he finally admitted under oath that he had assaulted her in an Arkansas hotel room. Hillary is the one who denigrates these women as sluts, bitches, whores, trash. As I demonstrate in the book, Hillary is also the person who hires the heavy-handed private detectives like Jack Palladino, Anthony Pelicano, who's now in prison, Ivan Duda, to keep tabs on, and then launch a veritable terror campaign against these women on an individual basis to silence them. So instead of being an advocate for women, I would submit that while Bill rapes them physically, Hillary then rapes them psychologically. And this is perhaps why Camille Paglia, the famous feminist, writes that Hillary is a fraud and that she would insert a husband who has exploited and denigrated women, or why the feminist writer Joanne Vannocci for the Boston Globe asks why Bill Clinton should not be held to the same standard as Bill Cosby. You raise the question of pay inequality. This goes far beyond the analysis that you indicate, which is dead on, but not at the U.S. Senate, where, by the way, senators have huge discretion, not at the State Department, not at the Clinton Foundation, no place where Hillary has been boss, has she ever paid women commensurate or more than she pays men. The notion of Hillary as a feminist is therefore once again challenged. As far as her advanced or evolving claim that she's an advocate for children, you know, what about the 200 girls who were sold into slavery by Boko Haram during her tenure at the Department of State, where she declined to put them on a terror list or to deal with them in a more aggressive manner? There's just no consistency here. I could go on and on. A new example, of course, is that once the nation of Qatar secured a commitment to topple Gaddafi in Libya, which they largely did through enormous payments to Bill and Hillary personally in the form of quote-unquote speaking fees, $1.5 million to Bill, $1 million to Hillary, and then $2.5 million to the Clinton Foundation. At the same time, by the way, they were bribing Tony Blair and Sarkozy, a reversal of American foreign policy. We go on to the national credit card, and our bombers in the end are used to topple and destabilize Gaddafi. Women in Libya have been put back 200 years. In the prior administration, although Gaddafi was no prince, women were allowed to be educated, drive a car, choose their own husband, be seen in public without a veil. They were subject to equal protection under the law. Now they're back in the Stone Age, and none of those rights are afforded to them. So for someone who is an advocate for women, not her foreign policy, not her domestic policy, and certainly not her personal record would match that rhetoric.
Roger, in the past, I've covered the issue of Bill Clinton's addictions. Sam Smith has been on, who has cataloged extensively Clinton's affairs with drugs and sex. And Nick Bryant, who you already know, has been on the program several times speaking on pedophilia. in high offices of government, including Clinton's relationship with Jeffrey Epstein and his underage girl prostitution ring. So I don't want to spend too much time on that. Nevertheless, could you summarize Bill's sexual addiction, something that the media, the left, the liberal community has refused to acknowledge, even if nothing else, to get him some help, psychological help that he needs, and also to have him come forward and to apologize to all the women that he has abused, and like anyone else who's in any other form of addiction, to try to rebuild their lives, and yet that has been completely denied at every turn. So when you deny something that there's overwhelming evidence for, then why should we believe someone when they're in the most powerful position in the world and we're no longer then looking at them on the campaign trail, making promises, dealing in platitudes, saying, yes, they would examine NAFTA as she did in the last presidential debate 4 years ago, but she did not, and take an honest look at what is likely to be the person in the White House, because we better know what's going on in her house in order to know what's going to go on in the White House, because we don't want another set of scandals, another set of lying to the public, saying anything, get elected, and then a whole group of technocrats and bureaucrats and oligarchs descend upon Washington and have total control, while the people who believed in her now see another side of her. So let's take a look at that other side, including the never-before-really-analyzed and deconstructed Bill Clinton's being a Rhodes Scholar and what he did it in Oxford in England, and what we know from Secret Service agents and others about how the Clintons treat each other in the White House, so that we have some idea of the character and the emotional and spiritual disposition of this person and her husband. Because a lot of people don't vote for the qualities that count. They vote for the image that inspires.
Yeah, I would have to make the case that Bill and Hillary are nothing like their public image. Hillary would have us believe that she's a kindly old grandmother. And that Bill, of course, is like a roguish old uncle who just has an eye for the ladies. Unfortunately, the real story is much, much darker than that. As I indicated, Bill has not only a sex addiction, but he's a sexual predator, meaning when he cannot seduce and get consensual sex, he then assaults women. You refer, interestingly enough, to his experience at Oxford. Bill never earned a degree at Oxford. Bill was tossed out of Oxford because he raped a 19-year-old co-ed named Eileen Wellstone. This is documented in both the State Department records and also the records at Oxford. In his official biography, Bill says he left Oxford because he was accepted at Yale Law School. Problem with that is that there's a one-year interregnum between the time he leaves Oxford and the time he begins at Yale. It is during that period that Cord Meyer writes that Bill was recruited to infiltrate anti-war groups. Remember, this is the height of the Vietnam War. In Europe, and that he was attending and spying on anti-war groups and rallies for the Central Intelligence Agency. There is little question about Bill's serial sexual assault. Some of these names, of course, you know: Juanita Broderick, Paula Corbin Jones, Kathleen Willey. But there's so many names you don't know. Eileen Wellstone would be an example, but Liz Ward Grayson, Christy Zurcher, Becky Brown, Helen Dowdy, Carolyn Moffett. This list goes on and on of women who were either raped by Bill, assaulted by Bill, or in, perhaps this is the most repugnant, bitten by Bill. Biting his victims is a part of his pathology. It's a classic disabling move. Juanita Broderick described this in NBC. Another woman described it to Mike Isikoff of NBC. That was Liz Ward Grayson. She would later change her story, but her roommate, who she encountered immediately after the rape, testified under oath several times about what she was told in the immediate aftermath of the crime. Once Liz Ward Grayson, who was Miss Arkansas, later Miss America, was offered a part in a Hollywood television production by Clinton crony Harry Thomason, she would slightly but not directly change her story. She now said that the sex was rough, that he bit her, but it was consensual. I don't know who gives consent to be bit, particularly when he bites through the upper lip, you know, as a disabling move. There's little question that Hillary is not the person you see on TV, that she is foul-mouthed, short-tempered, extremely violent. This, of course, is confirmed by various Secret Service agents and some former Clinton staffers who say that hypocrisy rules the day here. Last week she had a proposal for gun control, and in her proposal she said if you were accused of a domestic abuse, you should not own a gun. Well, as we document in the book, she has punched, kicked, slapped, and scratched, as well as thrown hard objects such as lamps, keys, ashtrays, books at her husband. She is obviously an extremely violent person. I don't know that we want a domestic abuser in the White House, but she clearly has a track record. We know, for example, that when she was in Arkansas visiting her ailing father, she learned that Bill had entertained Barbara Streisand overnight at the White House. When she returned in a fury, Bill was seen the next morning with an enormous scratch across the front of his face. At first, the press secretary said that he cut himself shaving, but once she saw the actual scratch, she was forced to admit that it didn't come from shaving at all. So that is really what you're dealing with. It is hard to understand how the mainstream media cannot see the real Clintons and how they have suppressed so much of this narrative. It's also interesting that Hillary often leads with her jaw, leads with her chin. Last week she put out a video aimed at college girls who had been sexually harassed or sexually assaulted, and she said, and I quote, "You deserve to be believed." Well, what about the women whose names I just listed, the Juanita Broderick's, the Paula Joneses, the Kathy Willey? Why don't they deserve to be believed? In other words, Hillary is an advocate for women unless you're one of those women unlucky enough to have been sexually assaulted by her husband.
We could also ask this question, Roger, and that is, what is it that differentiates what a person does in the White House and all the rules and laws and engagements and political decisions they have to make and be a part of, comparing that to their private lives? Should they not have the right to a private life, whether it is compatible with their partner or not, whether they are sexually inert or sexually active, whether they are serial cheaters and liars or they have come to some arrangement? Why is that important for the American public? Why can't they just have their own private life be private?
Well, if their private life were entirely legal, look, I'm a libertarian and a libertine. What consenting adults do behind closed doors is their business. That's why I thought the idea of impeaching Clinton over the Lewinsky matter was foolish. He should have been impeached for selling military secrets to the Chinese through L'Oreal, or he should have been impeached for taking foreign campaign contributions, knowingly taking foreign campaign contributions from foreign interests interested in American policy. Instead, we impeached him for consensual, rather distasteful, but consensual relationship with a 22-year-old intern where he, you know, used her as his private humidor. Distasteful to be sure. However, when your private life veers into illegality, assaults on someone else, assaults on women and rape, or the sexual abuse of underage girls, which is throughout the Clinton biography, when he was running for Congress, when he was Attorney General, when he was governor, and when he was president, there is indications, as I document in the book, that he and his brother liked to play with teenage girls when they were full adults. Then I think that goes well beyond their right to privacy. I think it delves into a real serious psychological pathology that we call elite deviance, where there are certain people, certain families, for whom the law doesn't apply. They have so much influence, so much money, or so much power, or so much access to the media, that they can rape, they can have witnesses beaten, they can intimidate people, they can have their own email server, they can mishandle in violation of federal law. They can mishandle classified documents. They can use drugs. They can traffic drugs. They can profit from drugs. You could even make the case that they can murder people, and there is no penalty. The Bushes and the Clintons come to mind. For those who say that my book is a partisan screed, you're just writing all this because you're a Republican. I'm not a Republican anymore. And because you're trying to affect the election. Well, I am trying to affect the election. The American people are about to make an egregious error if they elect Hillary Clinton president. But I've written a book that comes out in January. It's already listed on Amazon. It's called Jeb and the Bush Crime Family. One of the things I do in this book, The Clinton's War on Women, and the next book, is very carefully analyze the relationship between the Bushes and the Clintons and how they have profiteered together on the American people, how they have defrauded numerous charities working together, how they rehabilitate each other. Perhaps this is why Barbara Bush says that Bill Clinton is like her fifth son, or why George W. Bush says that Bill Clinton is his brother from another mother, which, of course, he then says makes Hillary like his sister-in-law. This is the Bush-Clinton crime syndicate. So, for example, when they go out and they raise $138 million for Haitian earthquake relief and a nonprofit organization, they spent $10 million in Haiti, and $128 million of that money donated by good people for charity to help people just disappeared. They closed the nonprofit, and they will answer no questions about what happened to the money. That is a classic example of the Bushes and the Clintons working together to line each other's pockets.
Okay. Roger, you made an assertion that Bill Clinton or the Clintons could have been associated with murder. That doesn't go lightly with me. If you make an assertion, I expect you to back it up with some substantial evidence or retract it. What evidence do you have to back it up?
I think the best example, first let me say that I conclude in my investigation that the Clintons did not murder Vince Foster, even though I know that is an article of faith on the right. Trying to look at it entirely objectively in the evidence of is absolutely clear to me that Foster took his own life. They did move his body, however, and there's substantial evidence of that. And Hillary, in her own book, Hard Choices, tells us that her immediate concern after hearing that Foster had taken his life was that his office would become a crime scene and federal investigators would have access to his most sensitive documents. Now, I was referring more precisely to the case of Jerry Parks, which is covered very extensively.
All right. If the marriage is clearly not for nurturing any kind of emotional satisfaction that we're aware of, how do Bill and Hillary each serve the other's personal interests?
This is about the quest for power and particularly money. Bill, in the years since his presidency, is worth $300 million based on the best estimates by the Wall Street Journal. Hillary has made somewhere around $250. Their daughter, Chelsea, says she doesn't care about money, but she lives in a $6.5 million home in New York. Her wedding cost $3.5 million. The liquor bill was $3,000, more than most people pay on their own for their entire wedding. So the Clintons are very money-centric. I think the real reason that they have erased the emails is because they show the nexus between the Clinton Foundation and the State Department, and someone has made a shrewd political judgment that they will take less heat for erasing those documents than they would take if the documents were publicly read. And there are numerous examples, the uranium holdings of the United States shifting to a Russian company after approval by the State Department, which only followed massive contributions to the Clinton Foundation, for example. There are many indications here that this is about money and power. If you've seen House of Cards, I would submit to you that Hillary Clinton is Claire Underwood, that it has always been the design that Hillary would follow Bill as president. Barack Obama got in the way of that succession, at least temporarily, and that they put up with each other's foibles and escapades and humiliations because they have a marriage of convenience, a sham marriage, that is essentially dysfunctional. But this is really about the pursuit of power, wealth, and high office.
Okay, something that has intrigued me is the way Clinton managed to become president in the first place, because when we look at where Arkansas ranked on employment, labor rights, standard of living, education, and health care, it was at the bottom of the 50 states when he campaigned. There really was very little Bill had to run on to show he was a progressive. And what I learned from your research, however, was the alliance that the Clintons had and Ross Perot, and it was Perot's ultimate mission to bring down George Bush Sr., and less so to become president. So can you share that story with us of how did the Ross Perot factor fit into Clinton's being elected?
Sure. I think it's important to note that Clinton was never elected president with a majority of the vote in either of his elections. He got 48% and 47% respectively. He always benefited in both those elections from a three-way split. Ross Perot was friendly with the Bushes, and he leaned right to say, to the most extent, had a good relationship with President Reagan, but he became obsessed with the question of whether we had left POWs in Asia. When he couldn't get any action out of the Reagan administration, he went out and employed a number of these soldiers of fortune to search Asia to see if he could get leads on where American servicemen may still have been being held. But what he stumbled into instead was the drug trade. He stumbled into the fact that the Central Intelligence Agency was trafficking in billions of dollars of heroin, mostly liquidating the heroin for the purpose of buying armaments. Perot, being a patriot, was aghast, and he elected to take this information to Vice President Bush. He could get no satisfaction from Bush. In fact, his lawyer, Tom Luce, Perot's lawyer, told me all he got from Bush was a grim smile when he presented his evidence. I think this was his motivation in running for president. Remember, he was focused on heroin trafficking in Asia. It's not clear that he understood that in working with Bill Clinton, he was working with someone who had been complicit himself in the trafficking of cocaine through MENA. But according to Jerry Patterson, who was the driver and traveling security man for Clinton during most of the 1992 campaign, Clinton and Perot conferred by phone almost daily and carefully coordinated their efforts to defeat George Bush 41. And it was really only Clinton's skillful manipulation of Perot that provided for a plurality election of Clinton in that first election. Look, one cannot deny that Bill is charismatic, and he's a great talker, and he has extraordinary campaign skills. As you point out, his record in Arkansas, well, not so much. He skillfully benefited from two three-way races.
I'd like for you to give us what you have in hard, actual proof on these scandals that we may not be fully aware of. The scam over blood donations among Arkansas prisoners, the Clinton Foundation that you alluded to earlier, and Hillary's Department of State relationship, particularly regarding Kazakhstan and weapon sales and uranium mining, and Clinton insider activities and scams in various trading markets. Would you address those three, please?
Well, that's a mouthful. Let's take them one by one. Start from the top.
Yes, the scam over blood donations among Arkansas prisoners.
Yeah, Sally Perdue, I believe Sally Perdue was the reporter here who wrote this story. You had a situation in which blood was being drawn from prisoners in the Arkansas system, being sold on the market. There were a number of private investigations that would indicate that prisoners who had not been screened for HIV were being you know, were being used to donate blood, although I doubt it was a donation. There were ultimately instances where 7,000 deaths were tied to this tainted blood, which facilitated a number both of private investigations and then ultimately a federal investigation. The reporter who broke this story had her house burned to the ground, and she was literally physically driven from the state. There's a long expert on this in the book. I do think that a subsequent federal investigation compared to the private investigation ultimately closed the trafficking of blood by cronies of Bill Clinton down.
All right. Let's look at Clinton's foundation and Hillary's, when she was head of the Department of State, her relationships regarding weapon sales and then deals to the Clinton Foundation.
Yeah, the Clinton Foundation is really not, in my opinion, a charity. It's really two things. One, it's a slush fund for grifters. It pays a disproportionate amount of its buddies for luxury travel for the Clintons, five-star hotels and private jets. The Clintons, including Chelsea, who is now legally responsible for what happens there. Also, an extraordinarily large staff of people whose experience is not charitable, but mostly political. So it was a warehouse for many of the operatives for the Clinton presidential campaign. Peter Schweitzer's book, which I relied heavily on, Clinton Cash, is the definitive, I think, expose of play for pay. The uranium deal, the arms deals that you refer to are heavily documented there. In essence, you could, or let's take the example of General Electric. General Electric has an enormous defense contract on Hillary's desk. I think it's a $232 million contract. It needs the approval of the Secretary of State. They are the parent company of NBC. NBC hires Chelsea Clinton for $600,000, for which, as best I can tell, she does virtually nothing. And General Electric gets their contract. You also have numerous examples of countries who are barred from purchasing arms from the United States, but after large contributions to the Clinton Foundation, they are taken off that list and allowed to buy arms. The uranium example that you note is the most egregious, where essentially a Russian company, a Russian individual, who now appears in retrospect to have been fronting for Putin, manages to get State Department control of almost 25% of the uranium production in the United States, which requires the approval of the Secretary of State after massive contributions from himself and his partners in that endeavor to the Clinton Foundation. So I would submit to you the Clinton Foundation is really a vehicle for the facilitation of massive bribes. This is going to be in the news here far more than it has been because there's a number of filings by the Clinton Foundation, which are clearly fraudulent, that have now been kicked back to the foundation for amendment. And it's going to be very hard for the foundation to amend those applications, or I should say those filings, which are legally required, without admitting the prior fraud. This is going to hit the fan here very shortly. There's a terrific analysis online if you go to charlesortel.com in great and more significant detail than we have time for here. But I think the Clinton Foundation is a $2 billion global fraud. And while Schweitzer did a yeoman job in Clinton Cash, Ortel takes this to the next level. Now, he published after the publication of my book. What he has turned up is really breathtaking in terms of the corruption.
There are many people who have firsthand or personal information about the Clintons' wrongdoings and crimes, yet refuse to go public out of fear of retaliation by the Clintons. And over the years, the pair have created an aura of fear around them. If you step over a certain boundary, you'll confront a response that you're not going to like. Now, it takes a lot to create a machine that can generate such fear in people, plus a reputation of vicious attacks on opponents in their rise of power. So explain to us how the Clintons operate in order to silence opponents and their political victims, including the victims of Bill's sexual conquest. And as I understand that prior to your book was released, Hillary already had her own war room prepare countermeasures to discredit your revelations. Is there anything you can share with us about which future efforts the Clintons might use against you?
Well, probably the single most egregious of the example of the kind of activity that you're talking about would involve Gary Johnson. Gary Johnson was an attorney, and he was the next-door neighbor of Jennifer Flowers. Now, Jennifer Flowers had a 12-year consensual affair with Bill Clinton. And just prior to the 1992 New Hampshire primary, that affair became public and threatened to scuttle Bill's campaign. Bill and Hillary went on a went on 60 Minutes in a very heavily promoted television show, which is interesting in view of the fact that it was a, quote, news show. He admits that he saved Clinton's candidacy and his motive was political. Putting that aside, within that interview, Bill admitted that he only trysted with Jennifer Flowers one time, that he'd only fallen one time, and it caused pain in his marriage. The problem with that was that Gary Johnson, the next-door neighbor of Jennifer Flowers, had set up a security camera, not to catch Bill Clinton, but because his car was being regularly vandalized and the owners of the apartment complex would do nothing about it. So he set up a security camera with the purpose of trying to figure out who was vandalizing his car, but what he learned was that Bill Clinton came and went from Jennifer's apartment many, many times. When the existence of this case became known, three Arkansas State Troopers showed up at his home, and they beat him so badly that they left him for dead. They dislocated both of his shoulders, both of his elbows, and lacerated his spleen, his liver, his kidneys, and his lungs, left him in a bloody pile, assuming that he was dead. We did interview him for the book. He has not recovered either physically or psychologically from this beatdown. They did, of course, steal the videotape. So it's a classic example of where the Clintons would actually use physical violence against witnesses, to suppress what they might say. The other example, of course, would be Kathleen Lilly, who was an active Virginia Democrat, very active in both of Bill's campaigns, wrote the introduction for the Clintons' War on Women, my new book. After her family encounters some financial difficulties, she makes an appointment to see the president to ask for a paid job, and what she gets is groped. She gets assaulted in the Oval Office. She is silent for some period of time because she doesn't quite know what to do about this. But when the Paula Jones investigation begins and she is contacted by investigators and it is clear that she's going to have to testify under oath, there is suddenly a veritable campaign of terror against her. Her tires are slashed. Her home is broken into and ransacked. Her windshield is smashed. Her children are threatened. Her cat is strangled and left on the front doorstep. A man jogs up to her, a man who she later identifies as Jack Palladino from photographs, and asks her, "How's your cat?" "He was a good old cat. You ever replace that cat? Hey, how are your kids?" "Yeah, I saw him get out of school yesterday. You want to keep them healthy? You're not getting it, are you?" So these are the kind of terror tactics that the Clintons use, both witness violence against witnesses, witness intimidation.
Roger Stone, I want to thank you for coming on and sharing your points of view on why Hillary Clinton, and actually Bill as well, because if you get one, you get the other, should not be the most powerful person elected in the world. You're giving a different perspective. Roger Stone, the author of The Clintons' War on Women. Thank you, Roger. Now, my next guest is Robert Fatina. Robert's in Toronto, Canada right now. He is a historian. He is an activist for peace and international human rights. He has authored several books, including A History of Desertion in the United States Military, Desertion in the American Soldier, 1776-2006, and more recently, Empire, Racism, and Genocide, A History of U.S. Foreign Policy. He's a regular contributor of articles on foreign policy, the military, Israeli-Palestinian conflict, and the U.S. intervention in the Middle East, and more recently on Hillary Clinton. He's written for Counterpunch and Mint Press. His website is robertfantina, FANTINA.com. Nice to have you with us today, Robert.
Thank you. It's my pleasure to be here.
Robert, I'd like to focus on the 12 years that Hillary served in public office, first as a senator of New York and later a term as Obama's Secretary of State. Now, as a senator, her record is one of warmongering, including the approval of the U.S.-Indian nuclear deal, consistently approving defense budget bills, going against the international community and the International Atomic Energy Agency's inspection of Iraq regarding weapons of mass destruction, authorizing our wars in the Middle East. She has voted in favor of most laws that build our now tyrannical surveillance state, and her record as Secretary of State is far from dismal, given all the conflicts and new authoritarian regimes she's partially responsible for creating, such as in Libya, that's hers, the Ukraine, that's hers, Honduras, and Egypt and Paraguay. And during the Arab Spring, she pushed for stronger U.S. support for the pro-U.S. dictators in Tunisia, Egypt, Yemen, and Bahrain. And she never raised a voice regarding human rights abuses by our troops, military leaders, in any of our conflicts. She continues to hold the illusion the U.S. is the world's most indispensable nation, a term used by Madeleine Albright when she served her in her husband's administration. And yet, she continues to receive the support from the Democrat ruling rank and file. You've identified considerable hypocrisy between what Hillary says on the campaign trail and her actual actions and words in office. So please summarize the overarching contradictions voters are faced with when considering whether or not to vote for Hillary in 2016.
Thank you. I think the main thing is, as you pointed out, Hillary has an image that she has established as being a fighter for the underdog, for supporting all that the U.S. proclaims to hold dear, yet her actions in those 12 years when she was in the Senate and then as Secretary of State certainly belie everything that she says. You've mentioned a few things that she consistently supports during the Arab Spring, supported barbaric dictators that supported the U.S. She voted in 2002 to enable President George Bush to invade Iraq, and we know how disastrous that turned out. She has used the office of Secretary of State as her personal, maybe cash cow is the best word, best term for it. She was lobbied by many companies, many major companies, when she was Secretary of State, and coincidentally, many of these companies donated millions of dollars to the Clinton Foundation. Now, that, to me, in and of itself, looks like a conflict of interest. But we can even let that go because that is not the most severe of her, what I see as the issues with Mrs. Clinton. You mentioned the several governments that she has either propped up or established during her time as Secretary of State, all of them cruel, barbaric, backward, but supporting U.S. interests. And that's the name of the game. As long as U.S. corporate interests are supported, then Mrs. Clinton is only too happy to support your government. Let's look for a minute to the Mrs. Clinton's close association with Israel and the leaders of Israel. Now, few people deny that Israel is in violation of many international laws due to the occupation of the West Bank, the blockade of the Gaza Strip, the killing, imprisoning, with complete impunity of Palestinians by Israeli soldiers and settlers, the expanded settlements on illegally obtained property. All this is documented, well-known, and yet the United States, under Mrs. Clinton, has given Israel billions of dollars. Israel receives more money in foreign aid than any other country in the world, and has for many years. And Mrs. Clinton speaks in almost romantic terms of Israel. What does this say about her, her respect for international rights, or rather for international law, her respect for human rights, her respect for the concept of self-determination? When Syrians were first rising up, she complimented them and said that she recognizes the need for an oppressed people to rise up against their oppressors. Yet she constantly criticizes Palestinians while she praises Israelis. So I think we have here one of the many things we need to look at in Mrs. Clinton as a potential president.
All right. I know there is a strong case to be made that would indicate that Mrs. Clinton has enormous contempt for international law. You just alluded to it. And human rights, including women's rights, which I want you to get into. And just as a side note, I can't recall anything in Hillary Clinton's record in public office where she has made any effort whatsoever to address the epidemic of rape in the U.S. military, especially towards the women serving in armed forces. However, there are several issues I would like you to address, and particularly in the context of how she would serve as the nation's commander-in-chief if she were elected. First, as senator, her lockstep support for Bush's invasion of Iraq. Second, her role in implementing the sanctions against Iran. When she spoke at the American Jewish Committee in 2014, she bragged that she was the architect for Obama's tough sanctions against Iran, even though the experts in her own department opposed them. Third, her romantic love affair with Israel you just alluded to, and also her relationship with AIPAC, as well as Netanyahu. And are there any other foreign issues during her tenure that stand out and particularly are disturbing, especially as the Arab Spring came, instead of supporting the people in Tunisia and Egypt and other countries, she supported the dictatorship and military regimes, not the people. Is it? And then why do you think that the Democrats choose not to consider this important or don't believe it?
Those are all good questions. I'm going to address the last one first. Why so many Democrats just think she's the next savior? Why they think that she's the answer to all the nations in the world's ills? I wish I had an answer to that. There is some mystique that she has been able to perpetrate over the years. It's similar to the belief among many Americans in U.S. exceptionalism. They think the U.S. is a beacon of freedom and liberty around the world, and only intervenes in other nations to bring them the same democracy that the U.S. has. There's no truth to that, and yet people believe it. I think there's a parallel with Mrs. Clinton in that people have come to believe that she is what she says she is, rather than what she demonstrates that she is. So I think her public relations people do a wonderful job, and what I don't understand is why Democrats do not look at the absolute facts and vote accordingly. But to go back to your other points, her support for the Iraq invasion, I think indicates her political opportunism. She is a political opportunist. At that time, there was great fear in the United States because Iraq was thought by some to have had something to do with the 9/11 attacks in the U.S., and even though that belief had been debunked by experts, there was no clear relationship between those attacks and anything in Iraq. Yet Iraq was a convenient scapegoat, coincidentally an oil-rich scapegoat, and so she jumped on the bandwagon to show her strength against terrorism. She was going to stand up to those terrorists that many in the U.S. believed were there, even though all the evidence indicated they weren't, and she voted for the Iraq invasion. Now, she has since said that was a mistake, but it was a big mistake, and it was a mistake that didn't need to be made. You had mentioned the atomic energy inspectors who were searching Iraq, getting unprecedented access to sites they hadn't been able to access before, and finding nothing in the way of these weapons of mass destruction. Yet George Bush told the UN they need to leave, Hans Blix particularly, who was heading that effort, because he was going to invade. So this is all part of Mrs. Clinton's doings, and so a war that was completely unnecessary, and whether or not there are any necessary wars is probably a topic for another conversation, but the war caused, it destabilized the Middle East, which was very volatile anyway. It caused hundreds of thousands of deaths, millions of new refugees, all because rather than taking the high road and showing any kind of statesmanship, Mrs. Clinton jumped on the bandwagon, I'll show that I'm strong against terrorism, and I'll vote to support President Bush in invading Iraq. So there was that, certainly. The next thing you mentioned was the sanctions in Iran, and that's interesting. Mr. Obama, during his inaugural speech, said he would reach out a hand of friendship to any nation that didn't reach back with a fist, very eloquently put, and Iran was not particularly playing his game. So she was instrumental, or was certainly supportive, of the U.S. imposing very severe sanctions on Iran. Now, generally speaking, these sanctions do nothing to impact the government. They hurt the people. They hurt the common working men and women and children, people that Mrs. Clinton claims to be so concerned about. These sanctions hurt them without really having any impact on the government. And that was certainly the case with the sanctions against Iran. It caused untold suffering for the people, but didn't nudge the government one way or another. Now, okay, Gary, also mentioned... Yes?
Go ahead.
You mentioned Israel and then AIPAC and Benjamin Netanyahu, and these, of course, are all closely related. I've mentioned Israel. Mrs. Clinton, she speaks of Israel in the most glowing terms, how it's in one speech she talked about how it's a blossom that needs to be nurtured. Well, if the U.S. were to give Palestine as much money as it gives to Israel, Palestine would be a blossom that needs to be nurtured rather than a third world country because of U.S. supported and financed bombing and blockade and occupation. So she talks about Israel. She has a close relationship with Mr. Netanyahu. AIPAC, she, like just about every other U.S. politician, bows at the unholy altar of AIPAC. She speaks their conventions. She supports them in any way possible and, of course, benefits from their very generous largesse as they funnel money into the campaigns of those candidates who do their bidding.
Robert, I have one last question before we finish our hour, and I want you to address it in a short manner, if you would, please. As Secretary of State, do you believe that Hillary Clinton is responsible for the rise of ISIS and perhaps even indirect support of right-wing Islamic extremism, such as the reemergence of al-Qaeda, since it was under her State Department and the White House that they began to support, train, and fund the so-called moderate terrorists? Your thoughts on this?
Yes, obviously she has to take some responsibility for that. The U.S. Has a strategy of saying the enemy of my enemy is my friend, so it supports rebel groups that work against governments that it disfavors. And this is certainly true in the Middle East. It's certainly true with the funding and training of jihadists who have become part of ISIS, and it's been true in Libya and Syria, and it continues to be true And Mrs. Clinton, certainly as Secretary of State, knew about, supported, if not suggested, supporting these rebel groups that the U.S. is now fighting.
Okay. Robert Fantina, thank you very much for being with us and sharing your insight. Robert's website is robertfantina.com. His latest book is called Empire, Racism, and Genocide, A History of U.S. Foreign Policy. Thank you very much, Robert.
Thank you.
And that brings us up to the end of this program. Thank you.